But then when the plague continues and doesn't get better, they turn on Psyche, and now they call her the accursed. Now you ask, how can they go from idolizing her to calling her the accursed? Remember, the same crowd who called Jesus the king on Palm Sunday was the same crowd that yelled crucify him 5 days later. I think perhaps Lewis has that in mind. Well, she's called the accursed, and in a pagan scapegoat ritual, Psyche is tied to a tree and left to be married to the divine beast. And the beast, when he marries you, they believe he really devours you. Now, I must say something about this pagan scapegoat ritual, because it's very important to the life of Lewis. When Lewis was a young atheist who loved Fraser's Golden Bough, he believed that such pagan scapegoat rituals were proof that Christianity was just yet another ritual, which is pretty much what Joseph Campbell believes as well. It's just a more complex ritual, but it's still a myth. It's still a myth. But as Lewis matured and later became a Christian, now when he looked again at those pagan scapegoat rituals, he saw them as foreshadowing, in spiritual language, a theological truth that was enacted historically, once and for all, in the crucifixion of Christ. So it's good to end with Till We Have Faces. It pulls together lots of Lewis's concerns. Well, Orwell doesn't want her sister to be sacrificed in what they call the Great Offering, but she cannot stop it. However, after it's done, she vows that she will at least do what Mary will later do, and that is go to the dead body and give it a decent, proper burial. Well, she goes up to the Grey Mountain, which is where the sacrifice was done. But when she gets there, there are no remains of Psyche. Of course, she's horrified and she wanders all over the mountains till suddenly, on the other side of the river, she sees Psyche, who is alive and well. Very strange. Orwell doesn't know what's going on, but then Psyche tells her that the beast was actually a gentle god, and that the beast has married her and taken her to his palace of gold to live as his wife. But the beast made one rule, that Psyche is not allowed to see his face, and so he always visits her at night when it's dark. Now, everything seems to be okay, but there's a problem. Orwell cannot see the palace. All she sees is a bunch of ruins. Psyche says that she's wearing a queenly outfit, but all that Orwell sees is rags. I mean, she can tell that Psyche is healthy and, you know, well fit, but she doesn't understand. Well, obviously, she thinks that Psyche is mad, that she has just dreamed up this palace because she can't see it. And Orwell urges Psyche that she should leave right now. Come with me and go home. But Psyche tells her that she cannot do that, because now she must obey her husband and not Orwell. This is the first time in the novel Psyche ever speaks back to Orwell, because Orwell is basically, again, a surrogate mother. Well, Psyche is terribly offended. Orwell is terribly offended that Psyche should heed her husband rather than her. And she's also, of course, suspicious about this mysterious husband that you can't look at. And so she decides that whatever it takes, she will, quote, rescue Psyche from this beast. Now, I must pause here a moment. The source of the story of Cupid and Psyche is a work called The Golden Ass by Apuleius, who is a 2nd century AD Latin writer. And any of you that know the original story of Cupid and Psyche will recognize that Lewis has radically reinterpreted this myth. Let me explain. In the original version, Psyche's sister, actually both sisters, go up to the mountain. In the original, both sisters visit Psyche, but they see the palace. But out of envy, they want to destroy Psyche's happiness. Now, Lewis's change, the change is that Orwell does not see the palace. I believe that this change yields a myth that is both spiritually and psychologically more profound. Let me start with the spiritual profundity that I find in Lewis's version.